Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Business Black Belt Radio. This is Burke Franklin, your host, where each week I interview an investor, an expert in business development, financing, marketing, or management, or an entrepreneur who offers some keen insights into building your business. And I am excited this week because we've got Arthur Lipper with us. Now, Arthur Lipper has been an investment banker, a financier, a financial consultant, a management consultant, author, inventor, and lecturer. Arthur brings more than 50 years of experience to finances and financing businesses. He, and today what he does, he offers financial and management advisory services. But over the years, well, he's been in business 50 years at least. He was a sergeant in the Marine Corps back in the early 50s. So he's been around and done that. But his real focus has been on financing businesses. And he's written articles, run magazines. He was the publisher of Venture Magazine. He's lectured all over the world on finance. He's written books on venture financing and entrepreneurship. The list goes on and on and on. He's amazing. So he's been a participant in venture financing for both sides of the table. He's been a board member with numerous for-profit companies and nonprofit organizations. And he's also developed a variety of systems to both manage and measure, the financing processes. And what we're talking about today is he's taken all of his experience and I would say some of the frustrations and ideas he's come up with really into a new method that will really help us raise capital. And it makes the entire process, it sounds to me, a lot easier for both the angel investors as well as us entrepreneurs. It preserves the equity for us entrepreneurs, but it also returns the capital and profits to the investors much faster, and that's what we're going to get into today. Arthur, thank you for being on Business Black Belt Radio today.
I'm delighted to be here, Burke.
So what's a nice guy like you doing in a business like this? How did you get started, and why was it finance?
Well, I have to go back and give you a little bit of my own background to answer that question. I've owned and started and owned two New York Stock Exchange member firms. In both firms, we had a house rule that no employee could own securities that were publicly traded. I felt there was an irreconcilable conflict of interest, did not want the people whose responsibility was to assist institutional clients to be concerned with the volatility of their own holdings. Therefore, I started to finance privately owned companies rather than, as I did not have an ability to invest in publicly owned companies. And that's the background.
So you've been raising capital, as a venture capitalist, helping people raise money. And let's just talk about the current capital raising methods because we're going to get into a different way to go here, which is very exciting. But just for the background on this, how do we typically raise capital? What can we expect?
Well, there are really only two ways of raising capital, and for an early stage company, the second way doesn't usually work. The two ways are to borrow money, and in early stage companies, the lenders are typically family and friends because the conventional financial institutions do not have the appetite to lend money to early stage privately owned companies unless the owners of those companies are willing to make personal guarantees and have the collateral to support those guarantees. The other and most common way is the sale of stock in the enterprise, which means that the ownership interest of the founders of the company are reduced by virtue of the shares of the company they have sold to investors. And the problem with that approach is that companies typically need more money than the original founders usually project or predict, and that the subsequent offerings of equity stock will reduce significantly the ownership interest of the founders. So it is not unusual for founders to end up with less than 10% of a successful company they finance, they form, does not mean that that is a bad, necessarily a bad result, but it is a result which denies the founders the control of the company that they originally had at the time of conception and formation. So the two ways of financing companies are to borrow money or sell stock, and early stage companies really do not have an ability to borrow money on at all acceptable terms.
Yeah, I've known some people over the years who've raised capital, and they always seem like they're always raising capital, one thing after another. And I wonder after a while, like, how is it you've been able to raise capital through several different kinds of rounds? And it almost seems like some of these guys are raising capital through friends and family again and again and again. And I just can't help but wonder, do you own any of the business anymore, or is it just all sold to all your friends and family?
Well, we have a basic conflict of interest in between the investor and the business founder, and that conflict in interest is really irreconcilable. The conflict comes from the fact that investors in companies only buy stock in a company with a single intent, and that is to sell the stock at a future date at a higher price than they paid. Whereas the founders of a company typically have a vision, and that vision requires increasing amounts of money as the company progresses, and the cheapest money that any business owner can have is the money that is not paid in taxes. So what happens at the end of a fiscal or calendar year in a successful company is there is a discussion between the accountant and tax advisor of the company and the principal, in which fully legal means of increasing expenses and therefore reducing reported profitability are discussed. Now, although this may suit the long-term purposes and in objectives of the founders of the company, the investors in the company typically want the highest reported earnings possible, even though that requires the greatest amount of taxes to be paid, because what the investors in the company hope for is to find someone who believes that the trend of reported earnings continue into the indefinite future and will be willing, therefore, to pay a high price-earnings ratio for the stock of that company. The founders of the company may feel that they want to pay themselves and a personal compensation comparable to what public companies pay their senior officers. However, the investors in privately owned companies would really like to see a minimization of the expense of running the business. And one of the focal points in discussions will always be that of executive compensation, as well as the associated expenses of where do you locate your office, what kind of cars are leased by the company, where do you sit in an airplane in business class or in the back of the plane. There are all sorts of issues which directly impact reported profitability, where the owners of the company may have a very different perspective than the investors in that same company.
So there's an inherent conflict of interest right off the bat, but it doesn't seem to appear like all this stuff doesn't really show up in the business plan. Everybody's on the same page, of course. And so as an attorney I worked with in Silicon Valley, Dennis DeBrock said way back when, he says, you know, you got to set it up where everybody gets rich the same way. And I remember you tell the story, you mentioned the airplane thing, where you'd finance a company and you'd walk on the plane with the management team to go to some event, and they're all sitting in first class and you're going back to sitting in the other, you know, in the back. And I just thought that was funny in a bad way.
Well, that's happened on a number of occasions in different forms. One can eat in a restaurant choosing from the same menu and have very different results depending upon whose money is being spent. The real problem for the founders of a company is that as soon as they sell a single share of stock to an investor, they, the founders, become fiduciaries in that their primary obligation is to make business decisions regarding the company which favor all of the shareholders, regardless of the amount of shares owned. Those decisions impact such things as executive compensation, expenses, etc. And being a fiduciary, particularly in a state such as California, has very significant and substantial requirements in terms of how decisions are made and who the decisions favor.
Wow. So, yeah, I think we're thinking about if I wanted to pay myself a big fat bonus, I have to answer to people, and they're going to have an issue with that. Or even back when I bought an airplane, people thought it was a toy. You know, it wasn't a toy. I mean, I wanted an airplane, sure, maybe for my ego and other childhood satisfaction. But when it was all said and done, the smoke cleared, the dust settled, the airplane really wasn't that expensive compared to maybe some bad hires that I would have. So anyway, but just all those decisions, I could see how that would add up.
Well, there is a legal liability associated with being a fiduciary that entrepreneurs and business owners seem to forget when the decision is made, oh, well, we'll sell some stock in the company, and that's how we'll get the money. Well, you get more than just the money. You also get a responsibility to the people from whom you got the money.
Yeah, I remember reading Howard Schultz's book, The Founder of Starbucks, and about the middle of the book, one of the things he mentions, he says, you want to be sure you have people who, in his case, have a passion for coffee and the coffee experience. And so often people will take money from someone who doesn't have necessarily the passion for the coffee and the coffee experience, whatever your coffee and coffee experience happens to be. And so you just take the money because you're desperate for cash. And you end up with an investor. Not only do you have a fiduciary responsibility to, but you got to listen to them. And they aren't on the same page, but they have an ownership interest, more than an interest in your business. And now you've got to listen to them.
Well, entrepreneurs should understand the statement I made before, that the only reason someone buys stock in a company is not because they like coffee, but because they believe that the results of the company, and by that they mean the reported profitability of the company, will be such that they will be able to sell the stock they bought at a future profit. There is no other reason, except in the cases of people who simply just want to help the entrepreneur because they're friends or family, but there's no reason for an independent investor to take any action that does not promise to have a profitable result in the future, and that result in companies will be a function of their reported profitability.
You know, yeah, I've seen in the past when I would teach a business plan class at these different events, and many of the people have these ideas, and they want to write a business plan, they want to raise capital, they want to get investors, and they really... I mean, they make the mistake of selling their product more than they want to sell their business, the concept of the business to the investor, but they really think that the investor is interested in saving the world, and this product's really going to be great. And to some degree, that might influence them, but, you know, they really don't, the entrepreneurs really don't see what you're saying. These investors want to make money, and they really... Not they, the investor, the entrepreneur, really sometimes, what's the word for that? They bristle against that because they think they should be getting help because they're nice people and they've got a good idea, and these investors are evil because the investors are wanting to make money. And back to your point, yeah, they should make money, and you should be in business to make the money because that's the deal you're making with these guys.
Let's talk just a moment, Burke, about business plans. And you are an expert in the creation and structuring of business plans. However, it's been my observation over the years that the purpose of a business plan is to get an appointment with a prospective investor, and very few companies, once they have the funding, actually follow the business plan as has been presented to the investor. Entrepreneurs hate making business plans because they feel it is constraining and restricting, and that they have an ability to devise a solution problems such as may arise. I've always advised entrepreneurs and investors to create a what-if list and to list all the things that they can think of that can go wrong in terms of allowing the company to achieve the profitability predicted, and to have a frank discussion with the managers of the company as to what corrective actions they would take in the event some of the what-if issues actually occur. But unfortunately, I think that in many cases, business plans are like prospectuses, and indeed, they almost are a prospectus in private company financing, in that people, investors and investors' attorneys, only read the business plan seriously, looking for divergences in corporate activity from that projected in the business plan when there are losses which the investor, through their attorneys, hope to recover. So
the business plan can and will be used against you later on, maybe.
It certainly will be if you make statements. If you do not distinguish between factual statements and statements of opinion, and what I've recommended in my books and what I do myself is when I get a business plan, I read it with either a highlighter or pen in hand, and I mark the statements of fact as presented to be distinct from the statements of opinion. You really can't be held as an entrepreneur responsible for a statement of opinion if it is reasonable and based upon an honest assessment at the time. But you can and should be held responsible if you misstate a fact, because everything in that business plan is written to induce the investment by the investor, and there is no use or the entrepreneur must be held accountable for statements of fact, and I believe that in business plans, it should be clearly stated what is fact and what is opinion, and opinion is frequently based on hope. And that's what investor buys into.
I was just saying, in Biz Plan Builder, the original intention really, well, it is, and I've said this even in the on our website and brochures and stuff, that Biz Plan Builder at some level is a glorified brochure to sell your business idea to investors, because investors have all kinds of advisors and on technical and marketing and finance and other places that will look at this plan and be sure that they're, you know, the chain is as strong as its weakest link. So every section counts, and they look for advisors who can help them in each section. So it's important to cover all those bases. But that said, okay, it's a brochure, but we also built it to be a strategic plan. So like Eisenhower said, you know, the plan itself is nothing. It's the planning that makes all the difference in the world. And so at the end of the day, the business plan really reflects your planning and your thinking that you've thought through all this stuff. And we also include a risk section and encourage people to state, these are all the risks. You know, that's not to say like in a private placement memorandum, which I call the anti-business plan, because it basically says, you see this part? Don't believe anything, just as a full disclosure document. But yeah, you know, it is kind of troubling that that entrepreneurs really, and there's so many business plan templates out there that I think they're really trying to make it easy and fast for people to write one to raise the money. Unfortunately, they then take that plan and toss it on the shelf when, if I was the investor, I'd expect you to build the business as you told me you're going to do it. And I think that's what we've really tried to build into Biz Plan Builder, is that perspective. Like, this is your blueprint. You're going to hire people who've read this plan, and you're going to do what you're talking about here. And if you do pivot or make changes, you're not changing the whole thing. You're just changing part of it. And of course, you'd communicate to your investors, and you'd probably be talking to them along the way to making those decisions. So, but yeah, I wish they would not just write the business plan to raise capital and throw it on the shelf and go off and do something else. I think that's a frightening thought, because if you put the effort into the business plan, you've really got a blueprint to, I think, get it right and do some good stuff if you follow it. But so let's talk about your new deal. How do you want to start explaining that?
Okay. First, I'm trying to simplify a process which has been made unnecessarily complicated, primarily by the intermediaries and their attorneys, because there has been such enormous profit available to the investment banking intermediaries because of the complexities that have been built into the system. We have a very simple proposition in investing in a business. And I ask everyone to think, what is easier to predict? A future level of profitability or a future trend of revenues? Revenues represent consumer acceptance of whatever the product or service is. Is this going to be a product or service which consumers will want to buy? And will the product or service, if well presented and well performing, have a natural tendency for revenues to increase? Now, that's not a very complicated concept. Is this something that you would buy? Is this something that you believe a large body of people would buy? Let's assume that you reach that positive conclusion. Okay. Profits are a measure of the skill of management the skill of management in converting revenues to profit, which requires a control of expenses. Some managers of business, conceivers and managers of business, have a wonderful ability to create a achievable vision as to consumer acceptance. That's all revenues, but have little ability to go through the process of managing a business. Therefore, if there are extreme variabilities in the creation of profit, and if there are large areas where management decisions can impact profit, some of which are intentional, some of which are not, but nevertheless, where profit is much more difficult to predict than the trend of revenues, why not invest in the revenues? That investment in revenues is called a royalty. A royalty is a financial instrument titling the owner to an agreed percentage of the revenues of a company for an agreed period of time. It's that simple. I'd rather have 5% of the revenues of a company than 50% or 49% 0.9% of the equity of a company. And in our process, which we were successful in obtaining a U.S. patent, in our process, the royalty holder or their agent gets paid the agreed percentage of revenues every time the revenues are deposited in the royalty issuing company's bank. So there is never a need to wait for the declaration of a dividend or some other device, and the decision regarding which is in the hands of management, as every time a check representing revenue hits the bank, the agreed percentage of those revenues is deducted and remitted to an agent of the royalty holder for, in our case, quarterly distribution. And that is a very important element of our patent, and it is what gives the owner of the royalty a distinct advantage over an equity holder or even a debt holder in that same company. And that really is what we're talking about, Burke, is a percentage of revenues. The revenues will be defined in the agreement. They will, in most cases, be net of returns. But that is an adjustment that occurs either annually after there has been an audit of the revenues or at some future date, because on the initial instance of receipt of the revenue by the company's bank, the agreed percentage of revenues is deducted and remitted. Now, there is a problem with royalties, and that problem is that the existence of a royalty will make subsequent financings more difficult and more expensive for the company, as the arrangement to assure contractual compliance by the royalty issuer is such that the collateral or assets on which the future investors may depend will already have been held in favor of the royalty holder. But that's a technicality. It's important, but I don't think we should take a lot of time discussing it now. However, the royalty holder has one other disadvantage, and that is that at the moment there are no organized royalty exchanges, and there is not a liquidity to the contract. Now, it is a lack of liquidity which justifies the royalty holder requiring a higher percentage of a company's revenues than will be the case when there are royalty exchanges, which we think will be in the next very few years. So the initially time, the return to investors in royalties is very attractive.
So let me kind of go back over some of this, because it makes some sense, and we've talked about it before. But so just thinking about this as an entrepreneur or even an investor looking at a deal, the way it's been done is you do the business plan, you project revenue. From revenue, then you project your profits. Now, we know the difference between profits, revenue and profits. There's all kinds of Hollywood accounting in there. You know, I could buy an airplane. Ooh, I don't have as much profit because I spent money on an airplane. Or I spent a bunch of money on marketing, or I did something else. But nevertheless, I project revenue, then I project profit. From the we project valuation, because at some point the investor always asks, so what's this deal worth? What's your company worth? How much? If I wanted to buy 10% of it or 20% of it, how much would I need to spend? So they're going to then buy stock in the business. And the other gotcha is, Okay, so I'm all hot about this business as the entrepreneur. I want to run this thing forever. So where's the exit? When does the investor get their money back? And of course, one of the top priorities of an investor is A, don't lose the money, as Warren Buffett would say. And then the second rule is look at rule number one, don't lose the money. So part of the issue here is calculating the revenue, figuring out the profit, calculating the value of the deal, buying the share, buying the equity, and then you got to wait and you got to wonder how long is it going to take before I can exit and get my money back on this thing, if ever. And it seems like angel investors are getting older and older and probably less likely to want to wait for the entrepreneur to get their act together. And maybe the entrepreneur doesn't want to sell their business and it's maybe this is not an IPO candidate. So what? Then they have to wait. But your off alternative is they can start recouping their investment, their paid-in capital, right away, or maybe we'll start within a couple of years. And the first thing they do is they start getting that money back, paid off revenue. So there's only one moving part. There's not several moving parts. There's just the one moving part that you can actually calculate. It could change and fluctuate, of course, but that's the risk. But nevertheless, there's only one moving part, and you are starting to get at least a trickle of your money back. And ideally, according to your calculations, we'll talk about. I'm looking to hear you explain how we structure this whole thing, but the big point is they start getting their paid-in capital back soon, so you're not at risk as much of losing your money as you would in a straight equity deal. Did I get that kind of right?
Oh, I think you have it kind of right, but I do want to make the point that to be fair, and I think FAIR are the four most important letters in structuring a deal, to be fair to both the royalty-issuing company and to the investor, the royalty itself is going to be of longer term. And I use 20 years as being a starting point. Now, I've recently structured a deal for a friend where I originally thought that it would require 20 years for the internal rate of return based upon the projected revenues to reach and exceed 20%. And I think, by the way, that a 20% internal rate of return is a reasonable investor objective. But as I was doing the numbers, the projected revenues for this particular company were projected to grow so quickly to such a high level that I determined that it would be possible, instead of a 20-year royalty, to create a fair return to the investor with a 10-year royalty.
Could you
And there
explain
is a
this point?
correlation. Let me just conclude the thought.
All right.
There is a correlation between the percentage of revenues and the number of years in which that percentage will be applied. Now, of course, the revenue rate can be, let us say, reduced once the investor has tripled their money. And it can go from 5% to 3%. And when the investor again triples their money, that 3% can go to 1% for the balance of the royalty payment period. So there are no hard and fast rules regarding royalties. They are individually negotiated. They do or should follow a general format, but the details of every deal is different. And it depends, of course, upon the balance sheet of the company, as the investor needs to have an opinion as to the sustainability of the company. Will they be around during the whole period of time in which they're obliged to pay royalties? And again, I agree with not losing money, and I think that clearly an investor has much less risk in owning a royalty, which, as you suggest correctly, the investment in that royalty is reduced every time there's a royalty payment. And the royalties that we structure tend to result in a full repayment of the amount invested to buy the royalty in 5 to 7 years. Now, what happens after 5 to 7 years is that every penny of royalty that comes in is profit. And as we are only buying royalties from companies where we believe the revenues will increase, the royalties will increase. But after whatever the break-even point is in that 5 to 7 year period, that money will be received without there being any investment in the company.
Okay, I just wanted you to I interrupt it earlier because I was afraid people might not really fully understand internal rate of return or IRR, and I want you to explain that briefly, what that means and what that means. You know, because I think it's important that the entrepreneur understands the investor's perspective, and because we're always selling the investor on our deal, so we need to know what we're talking about here. Would you just explain IRR?
Yeah, I will certainly try, even though it is a concept people have difficulty grasping. Normally, a venture capitalist, which buys a share of a company, assumes that it's only on the exit that they will receive a return. So they invest in the company at one point, and they hope that in 4, 5, 6, 7 years, the company will either be sold to a larger company or will be able to go public. But the profit of the company is point to point. And so if you have a compound interest table and you start in year one with $10,000 and you have $100,000 worth of value at the end of 10 years, a tenfold increase, that's a 26% internal rate of return, okay? However, that doesn't apply to royalties, because in the case of a royalty, you're receiving, if not every day, you're receiving a royalty payment, or your agent is receiving the royalty payment, whenever there are revenues coming into the company, and therefore your cost for that royalty is diminishing. And the return that you're receiving, the internal rate of return that you're receiving, is based not on your original investment, but on your net current investment. And so you reach a point.
The remaining balance of it.
That's right. And so as you're receiving the increasing revenues on a decreasing investment basis, that is your internal rate of return. And that is what we believe you should have as an objective, something like something in excess of a 20% annual IRR. Is that clear, Burke? It's not an easy concept. And what we've started to do in our websites is use a cost multiplier and show on an annual basis how many times the cumulative value of the royalties received have been as relating to the original investment. So they would, in the fifth year, if the cumulative royalties received have been the same as the original investment, the cost multiplier would be 1.0. And by the seventh year, if the amount of royalties received have been double that of the original investment. The cost multiplier would be 2.0. And many people, it appears, double thinking in terms of a cost multiplier rather than an internal rate of return. And there are tables which show you what the rate of return is if the cost multiplier is whatever it happens to be.
So wait a second. So I just want to go back. You had an example. If you invest $10,000 and 10 years later, it turns into $100,000. So in effect, and you're saying that's got an IRR of 26%. So as I understand it, and hopefully I understand this clearly, but the idea is I invest $10,000, it's worth $100,000 in 10 years. That effectively tells me that I've earned 26% per year on my $10,000 for it to turn into $100,000.
That is correct.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes.
So the investor puts up $10,000 or $1 million, whatever the number is, and they get 10 times their money back in 10 years. And effectively, they can look at it and go, yay, I made 26% on my investment every year, okay? Which I can imagine that with all the moving parts in between, how that can break down and not happen. But what you're saying is I put in my $10,000 and, okay, it could still turn into $100,000 in 10 years, but every year along the way, let's say I get $1,000 back, and I know this is a mathematical thing that your patented system actually calculates, which is kind of cool. So I put in $10,000, and let's say we start in year two or three or four or five, and I get $1,000 back. Like, oh, okay. So now I've only got $9,000 invested in this thing. So I got $1,000 back, but I'm still getting the royalty. And the next year, I get another $1,000 back. So now I've only got $8,000 invested, but I'm still getting the royalty. And in 10 years, I still get $100,000. But all along the way, the amount of money I've invested has been reduced. So I've been getting my money back. I didn't lose my money like Warren Buffett hopes. So that's really the beauty of your system is you're paying the person back so they're getting the return. At the same time, they're also getting that 10x return. So the IRR effectively goes way higher than 26% on that basis, which makes this a much better deal. I just want to be sure our entrepreneurs understand the internal rate of return and how the fundamentally basics of that is. And then, because it gets a little more complicated in terms of your deal, but I think at the end of the day, I'm sick of saying that term, whatever, the smoke clears, the dust settles when it's all said and done. You know, the return is much greater than that, but IRR is a pretty straightforward concept.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. It is the concept that institutions use in making investments and that corporations use in making internal investments as to the financing of various projects. At our websites, we provide the IRR tables and as well as allow users to enter their own data. But the way to understand all of this is to look at our various websites, rexroyalties.com and rexdebt-share royalties.com. are the two websites to start at. And both of those can be accessed, I think, through your website. That's correct, isn't it, Bert?
Yeah, we'll have all those links on the website so people can see how this looks. And you've also got some wonderful explanations as to how all of this works. But I think really when you can go in and play with a model and see how this sets up, it does show the comparison of, you know, if I was to, you know, sell stock in my business, what's my business going to be worth? What's the royalty going to be worth? What's the effective internal rate of return for an investor? I like it. I mean, I've been offering an investment deal to my investors, potential investors, I should say, where I want to offer them a convertible note where they loan me money. It earns an interest. There's a certain IRR on that, but it pays interest. And then in the two or three years when it converts to stock, that loan plus the interest on the loan adds up. And then using that number, we convert it to stock at a 20% discount. So they get a pretty good deal. Now, at the same time, well, we can go into why convertible notes are becoming, I mean, they're such a common deal, but as I look at that and I compare it to what you're doing, convertible notes suck. So, because for me, if I have a down round, if I think I'm going to sell those shares for, say $2 in 3 years, and I can't, I only get a dollar for them from some, say, an institutional investor, which the convertible note deal calls for. It says, basically, you give me money, you earn interest on it, and when an institutional investor comes along and uses their valuation methods, you ride on their coattails and their expertise, but we'll give you a 20% discount, so you get a better deal than even they get. But even if they beat me up and it becomes less of an investment than I thought, the problem for me, the entrepreneur, is that now I'm selling stock to my convertible note holders at even less than maybe the bad deal I'm getting from the VC at that point. And so anyway, there's other problems fraught with it. But here, I love how straightforward it is. It just doesn't matter what I'm doing. You get a small percentage of the revenue. Oh, let me ask you this. So we say a small percentage of the revenue. What are we talking about? We're not talking about 30% of my revenue or 10%. Aren't you talking down around 1, 2, 3% tops? I think you said something like that.
In one form, I'm talking 1 to 2% once the amount paid for the royalty has been recaptured.
Right.
That is certainly a formula, and that is the debt plus a royalty approach. However, if for some reason the company does not want to assume debt and has a straight royalty, we're probably talking somewhere between a 3 and 5% royalty, which can be reduced upon the cumulative value of the royalties received over the years. But as I say, everything is different. But you said something just a moment ago, Burke, that I want to qualify. If an entrepreneur comes to me, and of course there is a chemical reaction that occurs when any two people meet, and I like the young person, man or woman, and I want to believe what they are telling me will be the results of the company if I provide the funds for the company, my first thought is I'm being offered 20% of this company, which is going to be worth, based upon the entrepreneur's sincerely believed profitability, 10, 15, 20 times as much in 10 years. Well, why would he sell me that much stock in his company at a fraction of what it is going to be worth if he really believed what he was saying? And I think the answer is he's willing to do that because there's been no alternative. It's not because he's being dishonest. It's just he has no other way of getting the money other than selling something at way below what it will be worth. Well, with our approach, that issue doesn't come up because we're not concerned with the future valuation. We're concerned with the future level of revenues and the company's sustainability. So it isn't a matter of my saying, well, the bride is too pretty. The profitability isn't going to go from less than zero to X. I don't have to worry about that whole area of the transaction. All I have to worry about is, will the revenues increase? And I should mention that I would only be interested in buying a royalty from a company which had or was projected to have a significant profit margin, because the royalty payments come off the top. They're not a dividend. They have nothing to do with profitability. So if the company that we're talking about has a small profit margin, then it is not a candidate for the sale of a royalty. And certainly investors in royalties will not be interested. So that is why technology companies are favored by this approach. because they typically have a high profit margin, at least initially, due to barriers to competitive entry, and their revenues can grow quite quickly based upon the novelty and utility of the product or service they're offering. But you must have significant profitability as a business owner before you should be considering the sale of a royalty, and the same is true for an investor.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. I was going to say we don't want to talk about taxes, do we? Or is that just sort of like it's just paying back the investment?
Let me just talk about taxes a moment.
Okay.
From the perspective of the business owner, royalty payments are fully tax deductible. Of the royalty investor, there is no tax consideration, no tax liability, while the royalty payments are offsetting the cost of the royalty. As long as the royalty payments are a recapture of capital, there is no federal tax required. However, once the cumulative royalty payments have equaled the cost of the royalty, royalties thereafter are ordinary income to the royalty investor. Therefore, it is logical that the royalty investor perhaps sell the royalty to a non-tax consequence investor, a pension fund or an endowment plan or some other institution seeking continuing increasing income for an amount that gives them the return they were seeking, because that secondary buyer, a tax-exempt institution, will receive the full benefit of the royalty payment because they're not paying any taxes. But in all cases, the royalty payments are tax deductible to the owner of the business.
Right, okay. But even if the royalty investor didn't sell it to somebody else and they just kept receiving royalties, as I understand it, up to the point they invest, that's for recovering capital, so there's nothing to tax. After that, the royalty is just, would the accountant tell us, it was basically just ordinary income?
That's correct.
Then, it's of course, talk to your CPA.
It's the same as a dividend or interest.
Okay. You know, in the last few minutes here, Arthur, can we talk about a sample deal, how it might come down? Because you've got an interesting combination of what you've done here, where you're saying, okay, royalty investor, I need $500,000, but you're going to give me $50,000, whatever. You're going to give me an amount. And so it starts out where you're combining debt and royalty. So it's kind of like saying, I'm going to borrow $100,000 from you. I'm going to pay you back, $10,000 a year plus interest, kind of like just like a car payment. You're making a payment on this $100,000. And then we're sweetening the deal by saying, and then in year 6 through 20 or 6 through 10, whatever makes a nice IRR for this overall investment, nice meaning somewhere north of 25% perhaps, because you want your deal to be competitive. So we're saying year 6 through 10 or 6 through 20, whatever it takes, we're gonna sweeten the deal by adding a royalty, and that royalty might be 1, 2, 3% of my revenue. Is that so? Can you talk a little bit about how we can keep this in kind of like 10,000 feet terms, how this looks to an entrepreneur?
Well, it looks to an entrepreneur very differently than it does to an investor. From the entrepreneur's standpoint, let us say they want $500,000. Or they need $500,000 and can make a case that with that money they can create a mechanism that will result in increasing revenues. In your case, they would borrow the $500,000 from the royalty holders on, let's say, a normal interest rate, let us say 10 to 12%. It can be lower, it's all negotiable, but let us say 10%, which is far better than the company could borrow under normal circumstances, because it's really only high interest rate lenders who are interested in loaning to early stage privately owned companies, if indeed they are. And so then the interest payments are paid semi-annually or annually, but the amortization of the $500,000 can be monthly, quarterly, annually, or in a balloon, only paid at the end of the period. But in any case, at the end of the five-year period, the lender would have received back their money and an interest payment. At that point, there would be a royalty of, let us say, 2% until an agreed level of cumulative royalties had been received, at which point, for the remaining period, the royalty rate would drop to 1%. Now, if indeed the revenue projections were such that there would be a faster payoff, then either the royalty can be terminated or different arrangements can be made that benefit the entrepreneur, the business owner, because of the greater success of the company than had been projected. Does that answer the question, Burke?
So, yes, yeah, so in that part, you'd call it a redemption clause or some kind of redemption clause that says, okay, I'm going to borrow money from you. I'm going to pay the money back over time with interest. And then at some point, you know, and of course you're going to sweeten the deal with royalties over the next, you know, anywhere from 5 to 20 years. And then you could say the redemption clause would be, and, you know, and of course the investor, and I've had people come to me who I've paid royalties more often than not. They'll come back in a year or two and say, you know, is there a way you can, I need some cash. I wonder if you could buy out that royalty. And you think, okay, and you need to figure that out. And that's negotiating the deal. But the redemption clause would create that opening that would say, okay, look, I can buy out your future royalty at a predetermined formula. Let's say that, you know, would say, you know, if the calculations to date give you an internal rate of return of X or X in terms of return on investment, or they could give you, you know, by this point in time, 3X the amount of money that I borrowed from you, whatever way you want to look at it. So at least the entrepreneur has an option to shut off this royalty stream that needs to go out. Not that it's a bad deal, but, you know, some could look at that as I just want to stop the bleeding. But nevertheless, the investor comes out of this deal rocking and rolling with a really, really nice return on investment. And the entrepreneur is able to get into an investment to get the money they need to build their business. And so, I mean, even the contract you have, this is only 3 pages. It's not that horrifically complicated, which is beautiful.
Burke, in the last minute and a half here, let us say that you have at your website all the information regarding royalties that we have prepared. You have information regarding Pacific Royalties, the fund in formation in Hawaii. And I will be pleased through your good offices to answer any questions that the listeners might have regarding royalties. They are very simple. It's just taking an agreed percentage off the top line revenue and not worrying about the rest of the business.
That's incredibly generous of you, Arthur. I appreciate that. That's great. We put links, to your site that explain this so people can really get all the detail. I think your site at Pacific Royalties really explains it in nice step-by-step detail. And it is in plain English, which is nice. And your REX debt, we'll get the, is it REX debt dash equity? No. REX
share.
Debt. RexDebt-ShareRoyalties.com. Okay, great. That really gives you a place where you can plug in this thing and see what happens. It shows the IRR. It shows the valuation of your company. It shows the, I know in the business plan, typically nobody projects more than, 5 years out, but yours also has a provision. You can plug in your own numbers for your 5 years that you have from your business plan, and the remaining number of years, which could be anywhere from 10 to 20, whatever you want, you put in an annual growth rate, which you could say, okay, from there on out, we're going to grow at 10% a year or 20% a year. So you can project, you can get that revenue, quickly project the revenue out to 20 years because most of us don't really think like that, but nevertheless, what the heck? You put it in there, but that will print a table that you could then, I've sent one of these to one of my investors already. I copied the table and I put it into my email and explained to him in a quick overview of what this deal looked like. And it's a beautiful thing. Well, between us, we're going to figure out a way to help people put these together. Between you and Gion, we'll have a system. I think we could really, I'm looking forward to championing this because I think it really makes a lot of sense. And we've got a lot of customers who want to raise capital. And for the most part, no matter what you do, they're tearing their hair out trying to get investors to get off the dime and write them a check. And this is the best deal I've seen.
It certainly conceptually is, because if you have unknown partners, which is what you have really in the case of shareholders, it can be a nightmare. And this is just simple. You're just paying an agreed percentage off the top. It's just that simple.
That's great. Well, Arthur, thank you so much for your time and your expertise and the 50 years you've put into all this to come up with this. This is brilliant. And thank you very much for being on Business Black Belt Radio with me.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation, Burke.